Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
All right, Jim Potts back on the air. Thanks for sharing your Sunday with me. Well, today we're going to talk about the Youth Handgun Safety Act notice. Yeah, there actually is a law out there regarding guns for youth, believe it or not. In addition to that, we're going to be discussing America's only coup d'etat. Yeah, we've actually had one of those in American history. People don't know that, so I'm going to share that because it was considered an act of terrorism in the way that it all went down. The last subject we're going to talk about appears to be a very popular subject. I've been getting calls and comments on this one, why kids kill. Today is going to be part one, and we'll do part two, obviously, next week. And it's kind of an interesting topic, obviously, so we're going to go into some details and clear up some things that might be misunderstandings about why they kill. And before we get into that, though, I do want to, you know, on a sad note, talk about the fact that this week we had three shootings. It's like, when is this all going to stop? You know, some of this I blame the media, only because the media keeps discussing these things, putting it out on the air, etc. But the first one we had was in Wisconsin. And I talked to a lot of clients, as many of you know, your clients that are out there, regarding this business about the office and people opening up and killing, you know, opening fire on their coworkers, their bosses, etc. Well, in Middleton, Wisconsin, what do we have? A heavily armed man opened fire on his coworkers at a Wisconsin software company on Wednesday, seriously wounding three people before being fatally shot by the police. And the good news was, at least, that the response time by the police department was only 8 minutes after receiving the call. So that's pretty impressive. And apparently the motivation behind the attack was unclear. A lot of times it is. Because these individuals either commit suicide or they get killed, and you don't know why, what prompted it. Maybe some of the co-workers know. Investigators don't know yet why he targeted the specific people that he killed or attempted to kill. At any rate, that was in Wisconsin. Then you turn your attention to Pennsylvania. And in Pennsylvania, you have a shooting about a man who wounds four people, including a police officer, in a court building before he was killed by police. And this was, you know, around the same time, day before, day after. So now we have another shooting. And then in Maryland, at a Rite Aid center, they had a shooting. Three people got killed. And police say that the accuser is at least in custody, although the person has been apparently wounded in the process of taking that person into custody. But maybe that'll give us, or that individual give some insight as to what the rationale was. And that one, unfortunately, three people got killed. Another eight got injured. So, you know, we look at these things and we try to get through to work in our daily lives, et cetera. One of the reasons why I'm on the air in the first place is really just to remind people that you have to be so careful about how you interact with people. Some of these things, in my opinion, appear to be the fact that they were maybe upset about something at work, et cetera. We don't have all the details yet, but at least please be on the lookout when you're out and about and to hopefully keep yourself safe. Okay, now that we got that little piece behind us, I always like to read emails. I got an email, and it says, Jim, I am sure you are old enough to have been around during the Charles Manson murder spree. Would you have classified him as a domestic terrorist? Signed, Scott. Yeah, you know, for some people who maybe aren't as familiar, well, first of all, he just died not too long ago, so he's been in prison all these years. But Manson, he was considered a cult leader, no doubt about it. It was in the late 60s, and he formed what became known as the Manson family. So I'm trying to do a little education for those of you who may not know that much about who he was. And it was a quasi-commune that he had it's in California. And his followers ended up committed a series of nine murders at four locations in July and August of 1969. And in 1971, he was convicted of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder for the deaths of seven people, all of which members of the group carried out at his instruction. Manson was also convicted of first-degree murder for two other deaths. Now, I'll tell you, I did a little research on him. He came from a very bad childhood situation. He was in and out of juvenile halls, in and out of jail at very young ages, etc. So, you know, I don't want to say the script was written for him, but he certainly moved in the direction that he certainly wasn't going to go into the priesthood, that's for sure. At the time the Manson family began to form, by the way, Manson was, he was just an unemployed ex-convict who had spent half his life, like I just told you, in correctional institutions for all kinds of different things. Now, you know, what's interesting is that before he was a murderer, he was a singer-songwriter on the fringe of the Los Angeles music industry, and chiefly through his chance association with Dennis Wilson. I don't know if you know him or not, but he was the drummer and founding member of the Beach Boys. Unfortunately, Manson believed that what he called Helter Skelter at the time, a term he took from the Beatles song of the same name to describe the impending apocalyptic race war. And he believed that the murders would actually precipitate the war. That's why he started on that murder spree. So Scott, yes. Do I consider him a domestic terrorist? Yes, without a doubt. He was definitely considered a white supremacist. His ideologies were such that he just didn't like people. There was no doubt about that. But interesting is that the people that ended up being killed, I don't believe any of them were black. I believe that they were all Caucasian. So, yeah, he was definitely somebody I would consider a domestic terrorist. So at any rate, I just wanted to share that with you, Scott, and thanks for writing in on that. I have another email here. Mr. Potts, I am curious. There was a lot of discussion at work and on the news about active shooters and shooting. To your knowledge, is there any one place where we are most at risk or any place? You know, where would that be? I know we just have to be on the lookout, but I was curious if there was one place more so than another. Well, on that signed by Elizabeth. Yeah, you know what? Actually, and I would suggest people take notes on this one. It's just short notes, but active shooter incidents where you're most at risk. Let me just tell you, schools, 24.4%, they say. Government properties, about 10%. Open spaces, 9.4%. Residences, 4.4%. Houses of worship, 3.8%, and healthcare facilities, 2.5%. But here's the big one, businesses. The percentage of businesses, 45.6%. So what does that tell you? It happens at work. What did I just read off to you? Issues that happen with people at work. Look what happened at the Trader Joe's. The manager that got shot, the incident started even outside of there, and it ended up impacting somebody in the workplace. So businesses, that's where they're most at risk. And I guess it's because, you know, the people there spend a lot of time together throughout the week. Tempers flare. We live in a very diverse country, a very diverse state, a very diverse county, a very diverse city. We have people from all walks of life coming together. What makes you think that they're all going to get along? And the realities are they're not. So these personality conflicts clash. People lose their jobs. Some people handle it better than others. And then, therefore, you have that reaction. Oh, by the way, if you have any questions or comments that you'd like to share, give me a call at 818-602-4929. Or you can email me, as so many people do, at listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. And again, that number is 818-602-4929. So at any rate, Elizabeth, there's your information. Those are some rough numbers. This could probably be subject to change in a six-month period of time or an annual basis. It all depends upon the incidents that happen. Okay, I got a third email that was very interesting, but I'm not going to read it now. I'm going to wait to my piece on why kids kill, because somebody sent in an anonymous email regarding that subject matter. And I thought that the person in so many respects was right on point about what they said. So I will wait until I get to that segment to share that email with you. Okay, let's keep moving right along now. I want to talk to you about the Youth Handgun Safety Act. Yeah, believe it or not, this has been around for quite some time. And I'm gonna read something to you from former President Bill Clinton. He did a memorandum for the Secretary of the Treasury way back in June of 1997. And the subject matter was enforcing the Youth Handgun Safety Act. So this is not new. This goes back to 1997. So what is that, 21 years ago? And in that memorandum to the Secretary of the Treasury, he writes, "A major problem in our nation today is the terrifying ease with which our young people gain illegal or unattended access to guns. Firearms are now responsible for 12% of fatalities among American children and teenagers." Again, folks, 1997, this is being written. "Criminal use of firearms by young people is a national tragedy. Between 1984 and 1994, the number of juvenile offenders committing homicides by firearms nearly quadrupled. Moreover, firearms are the fourth leading cause of accidental deaths among children between the ages of 5 to 14 and are now the primary method by which young people commit suicide. A recent study, according to Clinton, supported by the Department of Justice, found that slightly more than half of all privately owned firearms were stored unlocked, and approximately one-third of all handguns were stored both loaded and unlocked. He pleads at that point that we must do all we can to prevent illegal and unattended access to guns by juveniles." And again, folks, this was 1997. And in my opinion, he was right on point with this. And that is a problem, because I think that adults have a tendency to take some of this for granted and they don't keep their guns secured. There's a lot of gun safes out there. There's also devices that you can purchase to secure the trigger area so that the gun cannot be fired. There's a lot that you can do. So let me throw that out there, that for those of you who do have these weapons, don't take it for granted that somebody's not going to use it. And again, he mentions about accidental deaths as well. Now, this goes back to 1997 once again. So let's take a look at what exactly the Youth Handgun Safety Act. What is that all about? Well, first of all, it's the misuse. All right, here's how they notice it. "The misuse of handguns is a leading contributor to juvenile violence and fatalities. Safely storing and securing firearms away from children will help prevent the unlawful possession of handguns by juveniles, stop accidents, and save lives." And again, this is the Handgun Safety Act notice that you can actually get if you go online. "Federal law prohibits, except in certain limited circumstances, anyone under age of 18 from knowingly possessing a handgun, or any person from selling, delivering, or otherwise transferring a handgun to a person under the age of 18. A knowing violation of the prohibition against selling, delivering, or otherwise transferring a handgun to a person under the age of 18 is, under certain circumstances," are you ready for this one, folks? "Punishable by up to 10 years in prison." So that's why some of these parents are, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but sometimes some of these parents are held accountable for some of these things because they left their gun in a position where somebody can use it. So parents, secure those weapons. But let me just tell you the federal law on this. The Gun Control Act of 1968, you can find that at 18 U.S.C. Chapter 44, all right? So that's the Gun Control Act of 1968, comma, 18 U.S.C. Chapter 44. And I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to give you some of that to tell you what it says. And here's what it is. And look at section specifically 922, all right? At any rate, it says, "It shall be unlawful for a person to sell, deliver, or otherwise transfer to a person who the transferor knows or has reasonable cause to believe is a juvenile, a handgun, ammunition that is suitable for use only in a handgun. Number two, it shall be unlawful for any person who is a juvenile to knowingly possess a handgun or ammunition that is suitable for use in a handgun. Now, let me just tell you, because I know there's going to be questions popping up, this subsection does not apply to the temporary transfer of handguns or ammunition to a juvenile or to the possession or use of a handgun or ammunition by a juvenile if the handgun, the ammunition, or possession used by the juvenile. Here's what they say. If, number one, it's in the course of employment. Now, I don't understand about in the course of employment, I got to tell you. So if we're talking about a juvenile, what job could they have, you will be saying? Well, let me just tell you. It says in the course of ranching or farming related to activities at the residence of the juvenile. Target practice, hunting, or a course of instruction in the safe and lawful use of a handgun. So what did we do? What did we just talk about? We talked about the law. Now they're already giving you an exception. Now, number two of that is with the prior written consent of the juvenile's parents or guardian who is not prohibited by state or federal or local law from possessing a firearm. So what are we talking about? They got to have written consent. Can law enforcement stop somebody? Well, look, under these circumstances, if they're on a farm, they're doing ranching, they're a juvenile, I don't know. If they're carrying a letter around with them, I doubt it. They're out there hunting, doing target practice. I mean, I grew up in upstate New York, and I can tell you that we were out there doing hunting, deer hunting, rabbit hunting, all kinds of things in terms of hunting, and nobody ever questioned it. Why? Because the environment that we lived in, everybody did it. You say, are the times changing? Well, look at it this way. You know, I've told you in the past, this whole thing about, you know, children and shootings and school shootings, none of this is new. So it even goes back to when I was younger, et cetera. And that was some time ago, folks, at any rate. The other thing is what they say, the exceptions, is a juvenile who is a member of the armed forces. So the law does not apply if they're a juvenile and they're a member of the armed forces. Now, that, again, surprised me because how does a juvenile become a member of the armed forces? Because my understanding is you got to be at least 18 to join the armed forces. So I'm not sure where that comes from, but it says the armed forces of the United States or the National Guard who possesses or is armed with a handgun in the line of duty. Again, I don't know any juveniles that would fit that picture, but there it is. The next one says there's transfer by inheritance of title of a handgun or ammunition to a juvenile. I don't know ammunition having a title. You know, handguns, you know, those have to be registered, etc. So the next one is the possession of a handgun or ammunition by a juvenile taken in defense of a juvenile or other persons against an intruder into the residence of the juvenile or a residence in which the juvenile is an invited guest. So what is that doing? That's opening the door to say if an intruder comes in and the juvenile picks up a gun, you know, to defend themselves against an intruder or somebody in the house, then obviously they're not going to be charged by this federal law. Now, the last one I want to tell you is also 18 U.S.C. 924 subsection A, subsection C. Again, that's 18 U.S.C. 924 subsection A, subsection 6. And under 6A, subsection I under 6A, a juvenile who violates section 922, which I just read to you, shall be fined under this title, imprisoned not more than 1 year or both, except that a juvenile described in the clauses as I just mentioned to you. Now, it says a person, also under that section, a person other than a juvenile who knowingly violates section 922, which is the first one I read to you, shall be fined under this title, imprisoned not more than 1 year or both. So you know what? So I wanted to tell you this. And by the way, if a person sells or delivers a gun to a juvenile, so like at these gun stores, and the person has knowledge or having reasonable cause, they have to be careful also because they can be in prison not more than 10 years or both. And if you have any questions about this, it's the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives really is the one who enforces these laws. And that's a federal agency, as you know. So, look, the business about whether, and when we talk about kids who kill, et cetera, you know, they're using guns. I thought this was very appropriate to discuss. But understand that these laws are in place But the laws are no good unless the laws are enforced. And again, I tell you, I think it all starts some of this in the home. Some of the things that I'm going to be talking about under the segment about why kids kill. You look at the homes, you try to determine whether or not the home was conducive to a good environment and things. I mentioned about Charles Manson. He didn't grow up under such good conditions. I'm not getting into all of his background right now. But you wonder whether or not some of these things are, in fact, factors that that make these juveniles, you know, who they are in terms of what they do in terms of killing people. Okay, the next thing I want to talk about right now is America's only coup d'etat. Now, if you go back to your basic history, when you were in high school, and that was my favorite subject, by the way, hopefully you didn't fall asleep in there. Coup d'etat, it just simply means an overthrow of the government. Now, as you know, the United States has been around forever. People, you know, 200 plus years, whatever it's been. And people think that the Civil War may have been some kind of coup, but that wasn't. Okay, so let me just clarify that. It's not what I'm talking about. A coup d'etat is when there's a government in place at any level, and there's an overthrow of that government where others take off and replace people and things of that nature. That's a coup d'etat. And this is the United States. We don't think about coup d'etats, and people think, no, that's never happened in this country. Well, it has. And because of the fact that I do a lot of research on domestic terrorism, et cetera, there, in fact, is. Now, look, what I'm getting ready to talk to you about, for some people, might be a little sensitive. But I don't do sensitive. I do facts, okay? So don't take it personal. This is information that I give out to the general public because I do believe in, you know, keeping the public general, the public, you know, informed. And this is just one of those pieces that kind of coincides with some of the things I'm talking about. It also came to light because of the fact that it takes place in Wilmington, North Carolina. And as you know, the hurricane just blew through there, wrecked a lot of homes, caused a lot of damage, took some lives, etc. And it's just coincidental that what I'm talking about today has to do with Wilmington, North Carolina. But I'm going to take you back a few years. I'm going to take you past that hurricane, and I'm actually taking you back to 1896. Because let me tell you, in Wilmington in 1896, 87% of eligible male black voters participated in the local election. Now, that led directly to a number of African Americans being elected to office, and it was one of the first mixed-race municipal governments in the United States. Now, ahead of the November 8, 1898 elections, white supremacists openly encouraged people to vote race, not politics. Why? Because their backs were to the wall. So they wanted the voters to get out and vote based on race and not politics. So they ran a campaign. They ran ads on what they call the white man's ticket, which supported candidates in each district. So you see the direction that this is heading in already. So in the months leading up to the elections, one of the local newspapers, the Wilmington Messenger, repeatedly ran articles about real and imagined conflicts between the black and white residents. Now, these articles followed a familiar narrative that the quality of life of whites in Wilmington was being threatened by African-American citizens and or that whites could retaliate without punishment. Now, take that into consideration that you had the percentage of blacks who were voting and they were putting blacks into office. But another issue that came up was the idea that black men in town posed a sexual risk to white women, and it was the responsibility of white men to protect them. Now, this was coming out in the newspapers out there, so you can imagine how this is going to be inflammatory. On August 18, 1898, Alex Manley, the editor-in-chief of the Daily Record, published an editorial that railed against the hyperbole. If the papers and speakers of the other race would condemn the commission of crime, because it is crime and not try to make it appear that Negroes were the only criminals, this guy Manley wrote, they would find their strongest allies in the intelligent Negroes themselves, and together the whites and blacks would root out the evil of both races. Manley went on to say that white women, are you ready for this one, fall for black women just as white men fall for black women. And that's simply how it goes. Now, we're talking, folks, 1897. How rational his argument? It was at that time sufficiently incendiary for the white supremacists, as you can imagine, once again. But it was this line that truly set them ablaze out there. We suggest that the whites guard their women more closely, Manley wrote, thus giving no opportunity for the human fiend, be he white or black. If you leave your goods out of doors and then complain because they are taken away. So again, you can see what's going back and forth here in the newspapers, because in the ensuing months, it was that editorial that came up time and time again. They ended up using the myth of needing to protect the purity of white womanhood and their outrage that this individual would dare use the newspaper to challenge them in such a way did nothing but create problems. And finally, on October 24th, there was a speech in the town hall in which Waddell, who was one of the big muckety-mucks at that time, I'll call him, in which he declared that he and his brothers wrote their swords from Bethel to Bentonville, the most heroic chapter in American annals, and ourselves were men too, and inspired by these memories, intended to preserve the cost of our lives, if necessary, the heritage that is ours. So you see what's going to happen here. Things are getting inflamed. So as a result of that, they became, they became so incensed, and they were concerned about Negro domination. In his words, he felt it would be a shameful memory, and it would be an everlasting warning to those who would ever even think that the blacks should be in charge in that area, in Wilmington. That speech also came out in the local newspaper, the Wilmington Messenger. Now, white supremacist Democrats continued to stoke tensions in the days leading up to the election. Because again, what did I tell you? 87% of the blacks were, males were actually, they were voting. And they were urging their compatriots to end the control of the populist Republican coalition, also known as Fusion, F-U-S-I-O-N. And then 2 days after the election, Waddell and his gang stormed the town. And of course, the town I'm talking about once again is Wilmington. And I've already given you the numbers on the number of blacks in Wilmington at that time. And they massacred these individuals. The day after the massacre, the local newspaper, and I'll get into that in a little bit, the Morning Star proclaimed on its front page, "Bloody conflict with Negroes. White men forced to take up arms for the preservation of law and order. Blacks provoke trouble." When it was all done, this guy Waddell, who I told you about, declared himself mayor. And here's the coup d'etat, because they took it over by force, took over the government there by force. He declared himself mayor and replaced with white supremacists the rightfully elected board of aldermen, as well as more than 100 police officers, market clerks, health officers, janitors of public buildings, the city clerk, the treasurer, the city attorney, and anyone whose affiliation with the Fusion Negro regime made them obnoxious to the people and the president administration. So what did they do? They threw out all the blacks and they put in all the whites. That's what happened, because they were being, these individuals were being elected as a result of the 87% of African Americans who could vote. So all these individuals were in these different offices, they had these different jobs, etc. And now these white supremacists overthrew that government and replaced them with their own. So that was the coup d'etat. Now, you want to know how many blacks got killed? Well, let me just tell you, they said that it was a couple of hundred. And now they're putting up memorials and things of that nature, though Wilmington doesn't want to call it memorials. They're calling it tributes, etc. And they're arguing about whether or not 10 people got killed versus hundreds. And the stories are mixed. The reality is that they considered it a race riot at that time. And, people were killed, no doubt about it, and the government was replaced. So that's what it was. That was our first coup d'etat and our only coup d'etat in America. It took place in North Carolina and Wilmington. You know, the Carolinas, people don't realize it, but the Carolinas, if you look back in history, there's a lot to the Carolinas. I don't want to say, rabble-rousers, but you heard about the Boston Tea Party. Most people don't know. The Boston Tea Party wasn't the first event like that. The Carolinas did that same thing about a year or so before the Boston Tea Party, the same exact thing out of the harbors down in the Carolinas. So that's not new. At any rate, that's America's only coup d'etat, folks. It was definitely considered domestic terrorism, by the way. It involved white supremacists who forcibly took over a situation. So there it is. I've given you a little education. Wilmington, North Carolina. We do send our prayers out to you, though, with this given hurricane that had gone through. And hopefully the waters will subside and, you know, things will get back to normal as quickly as possible for you down there. Okay, we're going to turn to this, to my main subject that I want to talk about here, and that's why kids kill. And I know some of you have been anxiously waiting for me to get to this, and let me just give you this little piece. I am not a psychologist, all right? I'm not a psychiatrist, psychologist, or any of those things. I mean, I do have my doctorate, but it's certainly not in that area. And so I did my research, all right? Now, the research that I did was off the internet. There's a number of things that I found out there, but I kind of honed in on one individual in particular who's a PhD. His name is Peter Langman. And he's been a psychologist for about 20 years or so treating at-risk youth. And he did an analysis of the psychological causes of school shootings. And his work was considered a breakthrough in determining why certain teens exhibit the potential to kill. So I relied heavily on his research. So to present this information to you, I wanted to make sure that I had the solid background of information to present to you, because I'm going to tell you something. This was also a little surprising to me. So let's get busy with it. I want to tell you, I got an email from a person, and in the email, the person said, "Jim, I'm looking forward to this week's topic, why kids kill. This question may be preemptive, but you hear about the upbringing of these individuals, and most seem to be normal kids living in normal households. Then the real story comes out after a search of their bedroom, only to find news articles they have searched on the web, ammunition they stuck in the closet, behavior that in my day would have raised concern with my parents. Could there be a mental or psychological issue, peer pressure, bullying? Could it be that parents are different these days and just don't see the signs of instability, or maybe don't have the tools or time to deal with the situation? I look forward to hearing what you have to say. No one seems to be safe with either kids or adults today." And this one is unsigned. Now, this person has some good insight, but this person speaks directly to some of the things I'm going to be talking about today, because there are some misunderstandings as exactly why kids kill. Now, again, this is a two-part series. I'm going to try and get through some of this. I haven't gotten any calls yet, but if anybody wants to call in, it's 818-602-4929. Again, 818-602-4929. So, look, when these things happen, we all look for answers. And there's many explanations of why school shootings occur that have been offered over the years. And some are based on research. Some are based on, you know, the information we get from the news and the journalists, you know, in the wake of the shootings. Common explanations focus on such issues as the influence of violent video games. I think we've all heard that. And violent movies, peer rejection, depression, and suicidal thoughts. The easy accessibility of guns. Also, side effects of psychiatric medications, the impact of bullying, and the consequences of being a loner who is uninvolved at school and has inadequate social connections. Now look, let's be real with this. In the wake of school shootings, a brief period of massive media coverage often follows. You guys know that. And much of the initial information that gets reported is not accurate. And by the time the more accurate information has been obtained, the media has moved on to other stories. You guys know this. Think about it. Even the ones that I gave you this week, the media comes out, they give you this coverage, and then it disappears. It disappears. So reliable versions of the events often don't reach the public. We only rely on that brief information that these media individuals are giving us, and possibly the witnesses who are speculating on what happened. So we got to go beyond the media to a more nuanced look at the factors that are often cited as contributing to school shootings. Now, let me just tell you. Often cited factor in school shootings is availability of guns. Now, you heard me just talk about guns a little while ago. And, of course, people always refer to the American gun culture about having all of these guns out there, etc. You know, they argue about the availability of guns. However, think about something. The availability of guns does not explain the school shooting. It's only that they had the availability of the gun, access to it. But it doesn't explain the whys. As a person who wrote into me asked about the and mentioned about bullying, you know, et cetera, you know, psychiatric medicines and violent movies and these violent video games. Let me just tell you, school shootings have also been blamed on psychiatric medications. That's true. Okay. But guess what? Research shows this is not accurate. It has nothing to do with psychiatric medications. Nothing. Now, the issue I can tell you that's received the most attention in school shootings is bullying. There we go. Even with the person that just wrote to me, what did they say? Peer pressure bullying. Bullying has moved from the classroom into the places of business now. So now it's become a common word. So that one has gotten the most attention. And that's all about what? The media telling us that the school shooters were victims of bullying who seek revenge for their mistreatment. Now, we can easily grasp and relate to the concept of being hurt and wanting to retaliate. If a student attacks his peers or her peers, it seems logical to think that he must have been driven to such an act. Guess what? In reality, that information that the media is spewing about the bullying is simply not accurate. The situation is much more complex than that. And before I even get into the detailed analysis of bullying in relation to school shootings, let me point out just a couple of points to you. All right? Now think about this. We're talking about the word bullying. So first, let's take a look at the geography of rampage attacks. Right? Because those pose a challenge to the idea that bullying causes school shootings. Shootings occur. Where do they occur? A lot of times in what? The suburban schools. Why don't you ever hear about the mass shootings or school shootings like this in New York, Chicago, LA, Detroit? If bullying were the blame, what are we to make of the geography of school shootings? Bullies exist in urban schools just like they do in suburban schools, but yet we hear about it in the suburban schools. Yet nearly all the rampage school shootings have occurred in small towns, the suburbs, or rural areas. Think about it. All of the schools have bullying. So why just specifically in those areas if bullying is the issue? The lack of rampage school shootings in major cities suggests that shootings are not simply responses to bullying. And again, as I told you, my research and the discussion I'm having you is based on Dr. Langman, all right, based on his research. Now, look, second, it's hard to accept that rampage attacks are committed in retaliation for being bullied because the perpetrators rarely shot anyone who harassed them. Go back and do your research. When specific victims have been targeted, more often they are girls who rejected the shooters rather than bullies who beat them up. This is what the research shows. And most often, the shooters opened fire on crowds of people with no attempt to kill anyone in particular. Think about it. It's true. What happened in Parkland, Florida? He rang the bell. He just started shooting people as they were running out, not targeting anybody. So how can the attacks be revenge for bullying when the shooters typically gun down random people? Now, look, because of these two issues, let's just consider the alleged connection between bullying and school shootings from several angles. And just for the sake of discussion, let's define bullying. When people talk about bullying, they may be referring to many different kinds of behavior: physical assault, threats and intimidation, verbal hostility, spreading rumors, or ostracizing peers. Although all of these behaviors can be hurtful, let's differentiate from teasing. Let's differentiate teasing from acts or physical aggression and intimidation. Bullying, as I use the term here, is defined by three elements, people. There's only three elements to bullying. The bully has more power than the victim, and this could be through larger size, greater strength, superior confidence, or force of numbers, which is many kids ganging up on victims, by the way. The second one, bullying involves physical abuse or intimidation through threats. The victims are made to fear for their safety. This means that being teased about one's clothes is not bullying. Three, bullying involves a pattern of behavior. Being pushed one time does not constitute a pattern of physical harassment. So keep that in mind. And I got news for you. In some cases, the shooters were the bullies. Not the victim. The shooters were the bullies, not the victims. And I'm going to be pointing some specific things out to you with some individuals. I don't want to name them right now, but I'll be getting into that a little bit later and possibly into week two, part two of this. But they were the perpetrators, not the victim of threats and insults. And a lot of these shooters were seen as scary and intimidating kids whom it was best to avoid. But yet sometimes the shooters include those who harassed others who were on the receiving end of insults or teasing. Teasing alone, however, cannot be said to cause school shootings. If it did, there would be murders every day at every school in the nation. Think about it. Kids tease. But that's not necessarily the reason why they come back and kill. Now, let me just tell you, some of the behavior of these individuals, I'm going to point some of them out to you, like the Columbine guys, all right, the two shooters there. Their behavior was often so annoying and obnoxious that they alienated their peers. Now, Eric Harris, you might remember him as the Columbine shooter, along with Dylan Klybold. They were teased in response to their own provocative behavior. In contrast, the media coverage of Columbine forced on them, you know, focused on them as innocent victims of a toxic peer culture in which they were persistently harassed. That's a one-sided view which became fixed in many people's minds. And it often led to the assumption that bullying is the primary cause of school shootings. And that is not correct. You want to know the truth about these two guys? And I use them only because of the fact that everybody remembers Columbine. Everybody remembers Columbine. If I ask you to name three different school shootings, unless you were personally involved, you probably can't even tell me. So I'm using Columbine for right now. But both of those guys had bad tempers. One of them, Eric Harris, he frequently erupted with anger, punching walls and picking fights. The other one, Dylan, he used to curse the teachers, throwing things across the classroom, slamming doors as he stormed out. What did this have to do with bullying? Nothing. They threatened and intimidated classmates and developed reputations for violence. They even drove some of their friends away and caused others to avoid them altogether for those reasons. They just simply gave them a wide berth. Why? Because these individuals were who they were. So you see what I'm talking about, and I'm going to get into what caused them to do this. I'm simply trying to show you that bullying may not just simply be the answer. Now, let's just talk about something hypothetically. If school shooters were innocent victims of bullying, this could not explain why they committed their attacks. To say shooters went on a rampage because they were bullied ignores the fact that millions of students are bullied every day without committing murders. The experience of being bullied does not distinguish a child who becomes a killer from millions of bullied children who do not. Think about it. It's been said that bullying was so rampant at Columbine, by the way, that the school had a toxic culture. This was well known. And think about it. Attending a school with a toxic culture like this does not lead to murder. There were students who were not happy at that school because they were picked on. Some got their parents to intervene, some transferred to other schools, and some quit. Trying to blow up the school and kill everyone in it was not the only option. And so the point that I'm making here is that these guys were painted in one way, by the media initially. And once again, here's the problem. The problem is that we get the initial news and it fades away because the media has a tendency to move on. All of these other facts come out as a result of investigations, and now we have a little bit more detailed information. There's no simple relationship between harassment and school shootings is what I'm trying to tell you, according to the research. Now I'm going to tell you, what's often missing from the commentary on school shooters is an in-depth study of the perpetrators themselves. Think about it. How many of you have ever seen on the news where they've gone back and explained and go into detail about these individuals? What kind of people were they? What kind of problems did they have? What happened in their minds to cause this? Was it just bullying? That wasn't it. If the attacks are not retaliation for bullying, then how can we understand the youths who commit mass murder? What makes them tick? That's what we have to look at. And the research is definitely coming online. Okay, I'm getting a call, so let me see here. Hang on. Hi, you're live on the air with Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. Do you have a question or comment to share?
Hello, Jim. This is Jim from San Bernardino.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, sir?
Just fine. Thank you for calling. How can I help you?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for taking us through this issue. I really appreciate your really informed approach and wanting to inform us. I have a question that's a little bit off topic. I know you're dealing with the school shootings and sort of the profiles of the young people that wind up doing this.
Okay.
But I did want to make a comment first. It just so happens I was listening to a discussion by a rather well-known psychologist, Jordan Peterson, and he was doing a mini expose on bipolar disorder, and he just happened to mention that if you don't, and he was talking about preschool age kids, and he was citing that if by age four, particularly young boys, if they did not, if they were not socialized in a healthy way from hitting, stealing, biting other kids, then this is what marked them as their future. Basically, they've started down a path which was going to lead them into pathology. So I recommend his study. So Jordan Peterson, I know, are you familiar with him at all?
No, but my associate's writing the name down. I will look at that because, as you know, we're doing a part two on this also. I mean, I don't know, Jim, we might go to part three, but because this is this is interesting stuff. There's no doubt about it.
But actually, Jim, I actually had another question for you.
Okay.
And this is what I said. I'm going to go a little bit off topic, but I'm just curious, how would you define, and I'm going to get my pen out, how would you define domestic terrorism? I'm a new listener, so you may have defined this already, but because I like your approach, I would be interested in to see how you define terrorism.
You know, I will exactly give you the textbook definition. Because it's the one that I kind of live by these days from that perspective. And if you look up the U.S. Patriot Act, by the way, USA Patriot Act, it'll give you that definition. But here's what it is. It's acts of domestic terrorism are those which, A, involves acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state. B, appear to be intended to, number one, intimidate or coerce a civilian population. Number two, to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. Or three, to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. And C, occur primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. Now, let me just tell you, the statutory definition that I just gave, it's changed many times over the years. And it's argued that acts of domestic terrorism have been occurring, you know, for a long time now. But that's the textbook definition of a U.S. Patriot, you know, from the U.S. Patriot Act. But the realities are that when you start doing the research on it, it's really, if you keep it simple, domestic terrorism are acts which are used to create intimidation and fear. That's your one-sentence definition. And sometimes it could be based on ideology. It could be based on, things from religious ideologies to ideologies such as, from like the white supremacists offer. I mean, there's different ways to be able to do the intimidation or coercion. So that's basically what it is.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
And
I appreciate it.
It's not a problem, Jim. And I do thank you for calling in. Please continue listening. I'm going to be talking more about this next week. And I'm definitely going to do some research on the other individual that you just mentioned as well, because I'm trying to get as much information as possible so I can be responsive to my listeners.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we had a caller there, and that kind of wraps up the show, but I'm not finished on this subject, okay? Next week, I want to be, I'm going to be talking more about this because I wasn't really finished with our part one, but I'll just continue to process on to next week. So, you've been listening to Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show, but let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/JimPottsAuthor. Be sure to join me next week. We're going to be continuing to discuss why kids kill. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good week. And I want you to be aware, be vigilant, be safe.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.